And welcome to another exciting and very warm episode of Kick Arts, Auckland's comprehensive art show, brought to you every Sunday night here at Planet FM 104.6, or you can live stream us planetaudio.org.nz and download our podcast afterwards, 5 minutes after our show finishes tonight at 9:30. So at 9:35 you can download it and send it around. It's going to be a great show tonight. On the show with me I have Chris Allwage. Did I say that correctly? Always, who's turn your microphone up, hey Chris. It helps to be heard. Who's coming to talk about Pride and the Red Ruby Cafe, Red Ruby Cabaret, Red Room Cafe.
Almost.
So many alliterations. I've got it right in front of me. You think I could learn to read by my age? But it just, you know, the heat. How are you coping with the heat?
Oh, I am actually loving it. Yeah. I have a lot of people dropping around me like flies, but I actually come alive. Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
I could stand a little bit more, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, the worst is yet to come, apparently.
Oh really?
Yeah,
I am going to be standing outside of my Speedo, awaiting this warm flush.
Tonight.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. It's a shame it's radio. I'm sure people will be going, oh, that would be interesting.
We might do like a live Instagram feed or something.
We could do that. Facebook Live. Facebook Live. Now, one of the times that we went off the air, my co-host at the time, Annie, went Facebook Live and we got more hits than we ever had. So maybe it's where we should be going.
Hey.
I should think about that. Hmm. And so Chris and his Speedos will be going live at around 9:30. Now, I've been away enjoying the sunshine and weddings up north and all sorts of things, and my co-host Georgia was on last week. She's away this week at the Laneway Festival, which is on tonight. And so if you're there, you're probably not listening to us, but if you downloaded this as a podcast and you went along, I hope you had a great time. It looks like an amazing lineup. There's so much good music going on in Auckland over the next little while. Have you been to see any summer concerts or gigs or planning to?
To be honest, I haven't. I've been so busy with my own stuff that I just haven't been able to get out much.
Your own stuff. So let's dive straight into it. What is your own stuff? So tell us about the Red Room Cabaret.
Oh, the Red Room Cabaret. All right. Well, this is Miss La Vida's concoction. It is a show, a variety act that has been made for Waiheke. And it is a festival that is held there, and it continues to go through the summer months. And like I said, it's a variety show that has all sorts of acts, comedy, singing, cabaret, burlesque, drag. And it's there to sort of add variety to the spice of life of the Waiheke Islanders and the community over there. And I am involved in their special Pride Edition show, which is on the 9th and 10th of February. And I'm coming on as a boylesque artist.
Boylesque,
yeah.
Which is different from burlesque?
So it's different in that I identify as a boy, and so I do the male counterpart to burlesque.
Okay. Yeah. So is the origin of burlesque just for female? Is it traditionally?
Well, traditionally it is very much female. There was no male counterpart when it very first initiated. Men back in the days of the early, I guess the origins of the burlesque art form were generally like tap dancers and like comedians themselves, yep. But they never really removed clothes. That wasn't their job. That was the ladies' shtick.
So can you clarify that for me? Because a burlesque is quite sexy.
It is, very much.
So it what's the difference between, say, a burlesque show and a strip show?
This is the classic question. Mm-hmm. Well, at the end
Sorry
of the day...
Sorry to be so predictable.
No, it's fine. At the end of the day, any true burlesque artist is always going to call themselves a stripper. I mean, that's essentially what we do. But we try to do it with a bit more class, with a bit more historical context, and with a little bit more art. I'm not denigrating any strippers. I mean, some of them, I'm power to them. It's a very empowering art form if that's how you see it. But we like to bring and we like to honor the art form that as it originated. So, you know, girls in the classic show gowns making, well, some comedic acts, I guess, like how sexy can I look taking off a glove or how sexy can I make me not removing my glove look, that sort of thing. And it was more about the play on the expectations of the audience more than anything else, which is why it was burlesque. Because obviously burly, meaning sort of comical or bawdy, is not necessarily the same as stripping, because they often didn't or reveal, as we would like to say, like Sally Rand and her fan dancers. She came on stage and forgot her underwear and had fans, and so she did an entire dance where she had to conceal her body, for the laws at the time said that she couldn't reveal anything, and thus fan dancing was born.
Right.
Hmm.
It's amazing how things start. How do you know how burlesque started? Was it?
It's been a long progression, and I've read many books about this. And to be honest, I can't say that I feel like I know exactly how it happened. I know it has many origins in places like the can-can scene in the Belle Epoque era in Paris. You know, when ladies would come onto stage and do their high leg kicks and occasionally might have forgotten undergarments, and thus this whole empowerment of the female body and this air of burly body near nudity was born, and this atmosphere and I guess male delight in such art forms. And then like over the years, I think it hit its stride comes sort of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, when that whole sort of like free love movement came in and women were really sort of being like, I'm a powerful being, and really took burlesque as an art form to sort of like be very pro-feminist and saying, I'm owning this body and I am showing you or telling you that this is who I am, and you can either suck it or you can enjoy it. And yeah, it was a very powerful art form, and I feel that many women found their stride and felt powerful doing it.
So how did you get involved in burlesque?
My journey to it has been a long one. So at the age of 21, I decided I wanted to be a dancer. That was quite late in my career.
So what were you... we'll go back a step.
Sure.
So you 21, that is quite late to
that
start.
That is quite late, yeah.
Because most kids start like 5 or 6. So at 5 or 6, what were you thinking you wanted to be, Chris?
Gosh, I thought I wanted to be an archaeologist. I wanted to dig up ruins in Rome and study old things. And that was me. And then most of my high school career, I was a very inactive person. My story came out many, many years ago, but I used to suffer with obesity as a teenager.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
I'm sitting across from you now going...
Yeah, so at the age of 14, I weighed a whopping 129 kilograms.
Whoa.
And suffered some mental health issues derived from that because I was mercilessly teased. And so I was a very, very different person back then. And slowly and progressively, I became more aware of my body and decided to make changes for myself and the betterment of my being. And eventually, when I got to university, I was a free man, per se. I could go out and do what I wanted or felt that what I needed to do for myself. And started experimenting through theater, which I was introduced to in high school, and I just loved being on stage. And then got the opportunity while I was at the University of Auckland to join a group and actually did some acting, stage acting. And I was just, yes, this is something. I feel something for this. And whilst I was performing, we had a girl in the group who was studying dance at the University of Auckland. Her name was Brianna, and she was just this amazing person. And I just loved to watch her stretch and do her limbering exercises and practicing her pirouettes. And I was just, you know, that looks incredible. What you are able to do with your body consciously and the control that you have is something that I really admired, having never really sort of known my own body and what it was capable of. And that sort of progressed onwards, and sometime around the same time I was coming to terms with my sexuality and started going out nightclubbing and fell in love with the art of drag, started doing drag performances. And one day someone came up to me. This is a very long story, I'm so
it's
sorry.
It's a great hey, you're our only guest tonight, and you've got 90 minutes, so go for it.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
Just talk away.
I was going to talk
it's
about
all about you, Chris.
It's all about you, Chris.
Well, that's what we're interested in. And is this, was this in New Zealand?
This is in New Zealand, yeah.
Because you're originally from South Africa.
I am originally from South Africa.
Right.
So moved here when I was 16. So that I think that was the tide that turned for me in me being able to sort of change myself. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So when I moved to New Zealand, nobody knew who I was beforehand. You know, the bullied kid, the shy kid, the bookworm and the artist. Like, no one knew that side of me. So I
was that an amazing time for you?
Yes, it was. It was this breath of fresh air, and it was so needed in that time of my life. And yeah, New Zealand was literally the birth of the Chris that everyone knows now. And yeah, it was a great thing that my parents did for me and my sister. So I thank them every day for that. But as I was saying, I was doing a lot of drag, and I was spotted at a show, or I was doing a show, and I was spotted in the crowd by someone who was involved with the charity at the time called Queen of the Whole Universe. And this was like a faux pageant that they used to put on annually to raise funds for the New Zealand AIDS Foundation. And so they came up to me after the show and said, you're a great little mover, and you're good looking as a boy, and you seem to make a good looking girl. So would you perhaps consider dancing with us or being in my show for this pageant? And I said, I'd love to. That sounds incredible. And, you know, at the time, I was still not even considering dance as a thing. I loved it, but it never clicked in my mind that that is something that I wanted to do. And it just so happened that the choreographer for this gentleman's number was Ty Royal from the Okareka Dance Company. And it was in one of our first lessons that we had, we were taken through like a standard ballet bar warm-up, and I had no idea what that was. It's like, I'm just going to copy people and point my toes and lift my leg and just do what everyone else is doing. But he came up to me afterwards and he says, you know, Chris, you've actually got a really great facility. Your body has a natural line to it, and you seem to pick things up rather well, and, you know, you've got a great look about you. So, you know, you should maybe consider dance as something, because I can see it brings you so much joy. And I said to him, you know, like, yes, it really does. But, you know, I'm 21 now. My dancing career probably should have started by now. and he said, yeah, you know, that is a consideration. But most people can start later in their lives. If all gentlemen can start later in their lives, we don't have the same demands of us as women do. So he said, you know, have a think about it. Just think about it. So I did, and later on...
Can I ask, what actually were you doing? You were at university
studying... I was at university studying classics.
Okay.
The little... the
vases and things.
Yes, the archaeologist in me wanted to do things. Yeah. So I was doing ancient Greek and Latin at university, and classical studies, art history, so forth. Wow. Yeah. Soon after that happened, I saw two shows, and those shows changed my mind about that decision. And that was the Ballet Trocadero, the Men in Tutus on Point. And I just absolutely adored what they did, because I love classical ballet, always have since a kid. When my sister went to ballet school, I was so jealous because I wanted to do ballet.
And you couldn't?
I wasn't allowed to, no. My mother took me into one session, and the ballet teacher looked at me and said, no, we won't accept him.
Oh.
And that was it before it even started.
Was that because of your size?
I think it was.
Right.
Yeah. She was just like, no, we can't work with him.
Isn't that a shame?
It is a shame.
Because ballet, we've had a few ex-ballet dancers and had contemporary dancers in here who've said they started with ballet, but it was so rigid.
Yeah.
That it almost put them off.
But you see, I'm slightly masochistic in that sense. I love it when it's rigid and is well-defined, and you can drill it into me until I pass out, and I'll be happy with that.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was that, yeah. So Ballet Trocadero, doing this art form that I absolutely adored, and doing it sometimes how I maybe... They were doing it on point, which is a completely unnatural thing for a male dancer to be doing. Unnatural in the sense that, you know, that's not the conformist or the ballet conformist way to do things.
Mm. It looks unnatural for even women to do it. When I see them do point, it looks really uncomfortable.
I guess I guess when they started it would have been, but I think by the time they come to like the corps de ballet or prima ballerina status, that I don't think it's even a thing they consider anymore.
Yeah,
but yeah,
do they wander around at home like that?
Possibly. I sometimes put my point shoes on for good times. And then the second show that I saw just a month after that was the New York City Ballet Complexions Company. And I just remember someone standing on the stage with this overhead lighting, and he just sort of stood on one leg and developed his leg up next to his ear, just without hands, and just slowly with complete control. And I looked at him, and I thought to myself, like, if I could do anything close to that, I could die a happy man. Mm. And it just so happened that Ty was there at the show.
In New York?
No. This was here in New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
And I bumped into him at the interval, and he was standing with this lady called Shireen Griggs, who was the then head of department for dance at Unitech. And he was like, Chris, I think you should meet this woman, and introduced me to Shireen. Shireen gave me her card and said, well, I've heard that you're a willing dancer, and we're currently looking for some more boys, so let's have a chat. And the following week, I went in for an interview, and she says, well, Ty's vouched for you, and we're happy to accept you into our dance degree if you'd like it.
Wow.
So I said, yes, I'm doing that. And so that's what I did.
Did you say yes straight away, or was there some thought?
No, there was a straight away yes. I think by this point, after I had seen this, I was just like, dance is the only thing I want to do now.
Ah.
And so, yeah, thanks to Ty Royal from the Okareka Dance Company, I did 3 years of dance training at Unitech. That was were the hardest 3 years of my life.
So tell us a little bit about that journey. So you hadn't had any formal dance training?
None whatsoever.
And so you came in probably with people who had?
Yes. There were girls in their class who had been dancing since they were 4 years old.
Oh, my God.
And they could do everything that I only in my wildest dreams had hoped that I could achieve.
So how did that play out for you?
Well,
there's a story.
I wasn't very popular in the dance circles till about the end of my second year.
Right.
My first year was just a blur of pain, painkillers, and sweat, blood, and tears. It was incredibly difficult for me. I mean, the first day that we had class, we were thrown straight into a dance conditioning called MNB, muscle and bone, and this is designed to sort of move your body in through all its ranges of motion and movement and flexibility through strength bearing exercises as well. And I was like, what have I signed up for? This is crazy.
Can I ask, were you doing fitness stuff for your weight at that point?
Yes. So when I joined the University of Auckland, I then joined the gym there, and so I discovered fitness classes. So I had been coming quite a fit gym bunny at that point.
Right.
So my fitness was never in question, which was that was my only saving grace at dance school, was my fitness was never the problem. Everything else was, however, my coordination, my understanding of the movement, and things like ballet. Ballet was one of the hardest things to learn, in that I remember Kimbrian, who was our ballet teacher, telling us that in our very first classes, like, this is the most unnatural thing your body is ever going to learn to do. Because things that are meant to be your abductors become your adductors, and we use your muscles in a complete rotated out position, which is very unnatural for the human form to be in. And then you've got to train it to be in this position to move through the sequences and all the little connecting steps that make up ballet. And that in itself takes months for that muscle memory to finally kick in, and that then you can only start progressing onto the actual exercises themselves. So, yeah, it was a trialing time for me. And there was that first year, I think I cried into my pillow many, many nights because A, I was in so much pain, and B, I just felt so useless. And it really sort of like would come to a crux every time we had student choreographies and everyone was picking who they wanted to be in their dances. And I was always kind of like left to the side, which was, you know, I was a strong guy, so I could do really well at partnering because, I mean, the guy's job is generally not to look that good, but to make her look good. And I could do that well. But when it came to the steps, I was always lagging. But then I said, like, and towards the end of my second year, I was finally beginning to hit my stride. I was finally beginning to kind of understand what was going on. And I won a ballet scholarship to Timothy Gordon's summer intensive. And then I went along to that and progressed my ballet a little bit further. And then my third year, I finally hit my stride. And I got the opportunity to work with Black Grace and did their putty that they worked on with some of the Unitech students. And really, really, really just kind of was living for the art form at that point.
So what got you through that first year of you crying into your pillow because of pain and being the kid not picked for the softball team kind of scenario? What got you through? What stopped you from going, well, bugger this, I'm just going to go back to classics?
That the occasional moment when you were in class doing something and you would feel like you were dancing, you could be lost into the beat, into the rhythm, into the sequence that you were doing, and you felt like that was your connection. That was me expressing something that I can't express in words. It's a very bizarre feeling that I feel that some people can only understand when they do the things that they love and they do them well. And for me, that was the sensation I got when I danced. I was able to express something that I just cannot express in any other way without moving. And that kept me going. It was that want and that need to move and to express that.
Did you have support through that time? From some external support to get you through? Any shoulders to cry on? Or?
Yes and no. I think initially my father thought it was a very bad decision for me to go from a classics degree to a dance degree. And I was actually...
Neither are going to earn you much money, though.
the true story is I did pre-med as my first year at university.
Right.
So I started at what every parent was hoping their child would do.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Olwege.
Doctor always.
You're required in surgery.
Yes, please. and then decided, like, no, I have absolutely no drive for that. There were people who were hungry for that degree, and I was just, no, I'd rather sit outside in the sun, thank you, than go to another lecture. So I decided that was not my thing, and that's when I went into classics, which I absolutely adored. To this day, I still love reading mythology and the books, and I love going over what little Greek I can still remember. But it was the theatre and the shows and being on stage and performing and being able to create art with my body that really just sort of cemented what it was I wanted to do. Mm. So support, not so much. I mean, they're always like, this is your life and we respect that and you do what you do, but we're not happy that you've done this. I did have a partner at the time who kind of just like was the shoulder for me to occasionally cry on, but he would also be just be like, you know, you've got to toughen up, Buttercup. This is performing arts.
Yeah. And it is, isn't it? It's a hard path to choose.
It is extremely hard.
In New Zealand.
And
anywhere really, isn't it?
It is. And I found it very difficult as well because there is a lot of conformity that comes along with dance in the sense that there is a strict way of being. I know we don't talk about it because we're overly PC these days, but there is a look that people go for in company work, and there are sort of body types and issues and things that used to exist. And so for classical ballet, I would never have been suitable anyway, even though that was my heart's desire, because I am too stocky as a guy. I'm not long enough, lanky enough, and obviously didn't have the years and years of training since I was 4 years old. So, you know, company work was never going to be much for me, or much of a gate for me. And I did love doing contemporary, and I still do. I love teaching it, and I love my dance classes with a passion. But also, it's very difficult to find work in New Zealand. There are only, I think, 2 or 3 companies that are able to actually exist year-round. The rest of the time, they're just short seasons of works. Mm. And as a dancer, it's a scary thing. Like, you can be employed for 3 months, and then what? So I had to find something else that would fit the void. And so performing, I used to work as a dancer for the Candy Lane Dance Company, her commercial dancers, which is great because that introduced me to ballroom, to jazz, to all sorts of other dances that I'd never before known and was then taught. And
so what did the Candy Lane Dance Company do?
So they do a lot of commercial dance, so like big commercial entertainment, so like Vodafone or Spark or the banks like Westpac, who used to hire Candy Lane's dance troupe to create entertainment for their end of year functions and right. So forth. So we'd be the spectacle, the dance spectacle.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and that was fine because, I mean, I always love putting on a show and I love the glitz and the glamour of it all. So I had to find something for myself that I could pull from what I knew but also be able to be true to myself and create art. And at the time, I was working as a club host and nightclub dancer. And one of the clubs that I was working in started this thing called Queerlesque, which is burlesque but for the queer community. And I was able to watch what people were doing, and I was like, oh, what is this crazy burlesque stuff? Is it just people taking off clothes? And at the time, I didn't really know much about the history behind it, but I thought, like, well, that sounds like something fun. I like dancing in my undies. Why not?
Who doesn't?
Exactly.
Even Homer Simpson dances in his undies.
There you go.
Yeah.
Body positivity. That's what we're all about.
Yeah.
And so the lady who was organizing, her name was Floss. She asked me if I'd like to be, or if I'd be interested in performing, and I said, heck yeah. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but give me a time slot and I'll figure it out. And so I did. I put on a few shows, Googled boylesque boys, burlesque, found a few links of people who were doing things. And I was like, oh, okay, so I can do something. And it was really fun because boylesque at the time was really not much of a thing. There were 3 people, I think, who were, well, Tigger, Boylesque, and the Scotty the Blue Bunny were New Yorkers. And they sort of like started or originated the whole boylesque scene, and what they were doing was outrageous because, like I said, there isn't a historical context for men to be in the burlesque art form. So we sort of started carte blanche and could create an aesthetic. And in burlesque, there's this neoclassical, neo-burlesque sort of, everyone's always hung up on like, what style of burlesque do you do? It's like, are you classical? Are you neo? What's this? So I said, well,
is there a difference?
There is. So classical burlesque usually is that which they're recreating the look and the aesthetic of the original sort of 1950s, 1960s, 70s burlesque artists. So, you know, the big gowns, the long gloves and the little boas and, you know, the glove peels and the little corset pops and the little pasties and the tassels and the paneled skirts. These are all sort of like classical gestures. And it's a lot of sort of like strut, 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 pose, strut, 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 pose, which is very exciting. And you know, also, like I said, very empowering for the women who do it. And then there is the neo-burlesque, which is anything that's not that. So those who'd like to be a little bit more artistic and off the wall. And it's, like I said, what people are doing nowadays is just incredible.
One of my favorite shows I've seen burlesque-wise in Auckland, and I can't remember the name of it, Mary Jane O'Reilly.
Inflagrante.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yes. I thought it was really clever because it had a real strong social message about women empowering themselves over men and domestic abuse. And yes. And the music, I went out straight away and bought the soundtrack after I saw that show. It's one of my favorite. One of my favorite soundtracks.
And I am still jealous that they haven't asked me to be a part of that show.
Are there men in it?
I believe they had a gentleman in it for a while, Jeff. I think his name was Jeff.
Ah.
But no, I think it's...
Did you enjoy the show?
I loved
it. Isn't it great? I've seen it twice.
And I knew most of the dancers in it as well, which made it even better, because that for me is a true blend of what burlesque is becoming, because it is now sort of... It's broadening its scope beyond the classical ideal of burlesque, and it's taking in a lot of other influences. So what Mary Jane O'Reilly did there was she brought contemporary dance to burlesque, and she was able to create the show, which is kind of burlesque but kind of contemporary dance, and melded it together and to make this amazing spectacle in theater. And I think it doesn't matter what the box is.
Yeah.
Like, it's if it's entertaining and you liked it, and people say, like, I call this burlesque, I believe this is burlesque, then that's burlesque.
Is it neo-burlesque?
That would be neo-burlesque. That would definitely be neo-burlesque. And so I do the same with my own, because I love ballet so much. So I have a couple of acts which I dance ballet in. So actually, both the acts that I'm doing for the Red Room Cabaret on Waiheke for the Pride Gala are ballet-inspired. The one is an ode to the Belle Epoque of Paris and the Siegfried Follies, which is...
Is that burlesque, Siegfried Follies?
It's cabaret cum burlesque.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a bit of a same-same but blur. Yeah.
Okay. I'm starting to get a handle, Chris. Starting to get a handle.
There you go.
Is there music...
So the music that I do for this act is the Lana Del Rey... Young and Beautiful.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about that piece.
So this piece is, for me, it's kind of like I just really wanted to express my feelings of beauty, I guess, and aging process, because, you know, I'm now a 31-year-old man, and by no means am I a spring chicken, but I'm by no means old either. But the hairline is receding. That's an honest truth there. And it's coming to terms with the idea of beauty in modern society. Like, are we still valid if we're no longer beautiful or young? And we live in a society of high consumerism, and everything we see is always like perfection, 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 perfection. And this song, I guess, is an ode to what happens if I no longer am perfect. And so it is this idea of me removing the things that make me beautiful and standing naked at the end of the song being, and now, do you still love me? And that's my feeling towards it, using the aesthetic of the Belle Epoque. So I've got this massive, big feather-tailed bustle that comes off the back of my corset, and it is a little super cinched corset with just bejeweled to the nines. So I look like a big old sparkling disco ball, really. But in a very sort of Weimar cabaret / Siegfried Follies Paris Belle Epoque era type way.
Should we have a little listen to the song?
Yeah, sure.
I hope I've got the right one. And then we'll have another chat about the process of getting from 16 to this point.
Sure, let's do that.
And body image, very important.
Let's do it.
Well, that's what happens when you try to spontaneously play a song that you're talking about. You get the karaoke instrumental version. Sorry about that.
If I were a better singer, I would have tried and sing it for you.
Well, do you sing?
I occasionally am forced to, but no, I don't sing very well.
You don't sing?
I'm not a confident singer, no.
Okay.
But if forced to, I can practice, yes.
Now, you said something before we played the song about, mm-hmm. you know, the song's about body image, and you come on at the end of it and say, do you still love me? Do you still like me?
Yeah.
How has that journey been for you? Because obviously, I mean, looking at you now, you look incredibly physically fit. You're in great shape. You're a good-looking guy.
Thank you.
What happened? And was it a hard journey for you?
That was an extremely hard journey.
You want to talk a little bit about it?
I can. I mean, it's partly a little bit like sad, but also at the same time, it's empowering for me. And I guess if it helps people as well, then I'm happy to.
Well, you talked about mental health issues and stuff, and obviously within the performing arts issue, we're having a lot of conversations around that at the moment.
Oh,
A lot around that. Constantly, because there are issues of, you know, mental health, depression, suicide, that, you know.
Well, that's exactly what was the thing that was happening to me at the time.
Yeah. And I think the conversations are really important, because whether you're a dancer or an actor or whatever, there seems to be this thing, you need to look a certain way. And the industry seems to be filled with rejection often, because you put yourself up and get told no quite a lot, more than you get told yes.
You build yourself up and you're always being knocked down.
Mm.
That's part of the industry. And that's, like I said, you have to have a tough skin, buttercup.
Buttercup. So your journey through that, you said it's a bit sad, but it's a bit empowering. Do you mind sharing that with us?
Sure. So, as I said, at 14, I was at my heaviest at about 129 kilograms. And that came through a lot of emotional eating that had occurred because of, I think, I had changed schools and I had moved into a different socioeconomic bracket at the time. So my family was never very rich. We were sort of like lower middle class to begin. And
this is in South Africa?
This is in South Africa.
Okay.
And then at some point around, I don't know what the equivalent is here in New Zealand. I was stat at one and then stat at two, I then moved to a different school.
Right.
So it's
intermediate school.
It's right at that sort of like 13, 12, 13 sort of age.
We call that intermediate school.
Okay, intermediate. Yeah. So I was going to intermediate, and around this time I was also beginning to, you know, become a bit more aware of my body and people's interactions and things. And so I think children become sometimes awkward during puberty, and that was beginning to happen to me. And at the same time, I was realizing that I was a little bit different than everyone else. And the new school that we moved to was a little bit unforgiving, in the sense that obviously the kids who were going to the school were a little bit more wealthier than I was, and so they had all the nice clothes, the nice lunches, the nice pencils and things, and I didn't have the same, so I couldn't really compete with that. But it wasn't never, it's like, it's not a kid's job to do that. You have what you have. But I also was quite, I think, effeminate. I'm not really sure, because I had nothing really to compare myself to, but I was always just marked out in the hallways as the girly boy. And I had naturally really, really red lips as a child as well. So even the teacher would come up to me and ask me if I was wearing lipstick, and I never was. And so it became this thing. I was teased relentlessly about it. And then obviously when you start realizing, when you're going through the flushes of your hormones, that, oh gosh, I'm feeling these weird attractions, which at the time aren't really sexual, but they are like intense attractions to people you shouldn't be feeling things for, like, or at least you think you shouldn't be. So I started a lot of comfort eating and then started increasing in size. And the more I increased in size, the more the teasing began at school, and eventually I started being bullied because I just became an easy target, and I was in this whole victim phase. I just, you know, once you're a victim, it's very hard to get out of that and be empowered for yourself and by yourself. And yeah, that resulted in me obviously going into a bit of a depression, a childhood depression, and consequently, I remember there were a couple times where I decided that going on was just not really an option for me, and I couldn't foresee any way that it could get better, and I just wanted to release myself from I guess the anxiety and the pain of having to go to school, because I would wake up in the morning, I'd cry because I just didn't want to go and face another day, and then I would cry when I got home at night because I what happened during the day. It was just this constant battle, and it was literally a gauntlet that I had to run from my yard fence to school gate. And it was just a really difficult period. emotionally. And like I said, once you're in a certain mindset, it's hard to dig your way out. And suicide is not a logical thing. It is not something you can, you understand, because when you're so in that space, you don't see the other options and you don't see what that would do to other people. And so, I think the first time I was about to stick something in my arm and I stuck the blade into, and then someone caught me and I kind of burst out crying. And that was my first attempt sort of thwarted, which was lucky for me. Mm-hmm. That they found me, and that was, yeah, kind of a little bit of a house arrest. I was sent to a counselor thereafter, and they were like, we don't know what to do with him. He seems to be fine. But I remember the counseling sessions quite vividly. This woman would ask me things, and I would just tell her what I thought she wanted to hear. Like, counseling when you're a child, when you don't trust people, is very hard, because I'm just going to say things that I think you want to hear, not things that I'm actually feeling. And yeah, so she said, like, there's nothing we can do for him. He's normal as far as we can see. And that was a complete lie. I was really desperate for help. And about a year or so later, I became a prefect, I guess, for a smaller school that I was sent to after intermediate. Because I think we do it differently. We have, like, primary school and then high school, and then you go to university. So I was in high school now. And we went on this team-building camp out at some resort up the coast in southern Africa, and it became very clear to me that I was an outsider. It was the most isolating experience that I think I've had in my life to that point, where everyone would talk at me and never to me, and whenever everybody had their sort of, like, games and their conversations, I was just always left out. I was never included, and when I tried to be included, they would just be like, oh, why are you so weird, go away, like, so you know, children can be really cruel.
They are, though, aren't they? That's and terribly cruel.
And and that just drove me into, I was already in a funk, and that just drove me so deep that I couldn't see out. And I snuck out of the cabin that night, and I went to the nearest medical box. And one of the gentlemen who was staying in the house suffered from a heart condition, and he had all these pills everywhere. And I think I opened like 3 or 4 tubs, and I just swallowed everything I could find.
Wow.
And then ran up the beach. And yeah, there came a moment, I think, either when I started digesting the pills or, I don't know, something was taking effect. I kind of went into this, like, really weird headspace. That I guess I found the will to fight. There was this very clear moment where I was like, holy shit, what have I done? And I started convulsing and started vomiting up, thankfully, most of the pills. And yeah, I cried into the sand for a good few hours, and then traipsed myself back with this incredibly bad stomach ache. Luckily, I had managed to come out of that unscathed, but that was my second attempt. And from that moment, I had kind of put it on myself that I was going to be myself, but in a way that I could foster my own self without anybody else knowing. So I was, self-preservation without anyone actually knowing what I was doing, because I was in a very Christian environment, and I've got nothing against religions other than sometimes the people who who govern or pastor or direct. So things are often very misguided and don't teach love very well.
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah.
So your family were church-based, or the school was?
The school was, and I think consequently my family was, for the sake of appearances. Right. And yeah, I was around the same time, I was beginning to now really sort of cement the idea. Like, I know what I am. I've come to terms with the fact that I think I might be gay or might be bi. I'm not really sure. I've never really had any experiences either way. But I just felt like, okay, so I am different, and this is something that I'm going to have to keep hidden. And I had told someone that I confided in. We weren't very good friends, but he was the only one I had at the time. And I said to him, I didn't say I was gay, but I said, you know, I think people should just be able to love freely whom they love, because love is just, I think, free and comes in many forms. And he then told his mother, who happened to be the deputy principal of our school, And there was an intervention held for me because this is not normal. And I was called into the office, and they pretended to call my mum and ask her that if they could have permission to see to my my issue. And I was, I was forcibly exercised in a sort of like corrective therapy type session. Yeah, because gay is a demon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, some people believe, I mean, there was in the 60s, wasn't there, was a therapy where they electroshocked therapy.
Well, they did, and that's been banned since because I realized, like, oh, whoops, that's not actually a disease.
Yeah. Oh, hang on.
Yeah, so it was a very harrowing time in my life, and after that, and that coincided with the then suicide attempt, I just sort of lost contact with people for a while. I didn't know how to talk to my parents on a normal level other than just basic interaction. I didn't really share my feelings with anyone, and I became a very isolated person. And it was around that same time that my family had decided to move to New Zealand. So
what made that decision?
That decision was because in South Africa, the political climate at the time was very difficult, very oppressive, and it was in the full sort of pendulum swing of the affirmative action. So just after apartheid was abolished, South Africa decided that they need to raise up local minority groups that had been before sort of suppressed and give them equal opportunities, which is a great incentive, but they did it in a sense that sort of undermined and undercut others' hard work. And it became really clear that my sister and I were probably going to struggle to find work or equal opportunity in South Africa under that sort of pendulum swing. So they decided for a better opportunity for my sister and myself to sort of be who we wanted to be.
A doctor.
Yes. Oh my gosh. A doctor. They decided that the move to New Zealand would have been the best in our favor. They packed up ship and off we went to New Zealand. And like I said, that was the breath of fresh air that I needed to be able to reinvent myself and take myself away from that oppressive environment that I was before just being sort of caged in. Mm. And it was the best thing they could have ever done for me.
Is that when you started focusing on your health, your fitness, when you came here?
I sort of started already in South Africa. I started reading a lot of self-help books and, you know, trying to be my own hero and change the way I was
eating. There are so many of those. Which one do you pick?
Yeah, it is. So I started reading about religions because I was so angry at God for a while because it's like, why would someone so loving be so cruel? Mm. And so I started really reading on alternative religions and just religions in general and just trying to discover what this whole truth was about. And so even now today, I wouldn't call myself Christian. I would call myself spiritually eclectic. I still believe that there is a greater power out there, some energy or force, but I'm not going to give it a name because in giving it a name, I'm going to give it a religion and a whole bunch of crazy people who are going to tell you otherwise. Mm. So...
And they're going to ask for lots of money.
Exactly.
So they can buy motorbikes and four-wheel drives.
That's the one.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, and buy big, expensive buildings.
Yeah. If only that happened in the arts.
I know, I wish, right?
Yeah. Wouldn't that be great if you could just go, hey, guys, I'm going to do a show. Donate. Tithe to me. Tithe 10% of your income.
I'm going to start a Patreon account. Give me some money.
So how do you survive now? I mean, that's been an incredible journey for you.
It has.
And, you know, 15 years since you've been here from South Africa?
Yep, 15 years now, yeah.
And so you're teaching burlesque fitness. You teach fitness classes.
I teach fitness classes. I do. So the most unfit person to one of the fittest people I know.
Yeah.
It's
an inspiring story. See, you should be writing a self-help book.
I should.
With a podcast and selling recipes, and you could make a fortune.
Well, I could do. I mean, I had an opportunity to almost do something like that. In 2014, I won the New Zealand Fitness Model of the Year Award.
Well.
Oh, there you go. But that did absolutely nothing for me. Mm. That was just me being skinny and hungry all the time. It wasn't really fun.
There's that body image thing again. And the fitness industry, it's the same as the acting industry and
I think they're just as bad as each other, to be honest. Yeah. I think it's almost slightly worse in the fitness industry because there are people who actually support that.
Yeah.
I mean, their entire like supplement companies and ranges of people are just like, get skinny, get skinny, get skinny. It's all in your face all the time. And people become so obsessive about it.
Yeah.
And it's like, just be a normal human being. Enjoy your food. Enjoy your life. Find something that you love doing. Be active as often as you can. These are just like, that's the basic recipe of life. Do something that brings you joy and the rest will fall into place. And
so you're doing that with your life journey. So
I am.
You wake up in the morning and you do what you love.
I do. I absolutely love, I believe that I've been put on this earth to create happiness and shared experiences for people to enjoy. So in one way that I do that, I facilitate that by teaching group fitness classes. And that is my main income throughout the week. That is how I pay my bills. I teach at the University of Auckland, a next generation Auckland domain. And I teach things from bar fit, which is like a...
So you know how to drink at the bar?
No. Bar is in ballet bar.
Oh, okay.
So I teach a ballet-inspired fitness class at next generation, which is one of the popular classes there. Yeah. I teach things like flow and power yoga. I teach pump classes, dance fit classes, pretty much anything and everything you can think of. I am qualified in some way or form or other. Mm. And then on top of that, I teach my dance classes. So I teach, I did teach contemporary and ballet, and currently I'm still teaching burlesque as a summer intensive through the University of Auckland.
Wow.
And for me, I just the experience of being able to give people either the joy that I have for dance through my dance classes and seeing people just come alive. You can see their eyes just glow when they really get a move or they get the feeling that you're going for. And I'm always telling my people in my classes, like, I don't care if you get it right. What I care is how it feels when you do it. Because for me, that's more important than knowing the steps, is doing it with a purpose.
And a passion.
Yeah. And finding that passion in people. And with passion comes empowerment as well. Like when you see them coming in week after week, and every week there's just this little like layer of oppression that has just been shed, and there's just like this flower that petal by petal opens itself until eventually by the end of the term you've got this fully fledged, empowered, sort of like really open and glowing person in front of you. Like, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. Like, check it, you.
And I've been there all along, but we hide ourselves, don't we?
We do. We're so covered and fettered by all everyday life here, and it's really upsetting. And I see it in all the classes that I teach. Yeah. People come in with their sad, long faces, their bad postures. They've been so affected by modern life that they've forgotten to reach and extend and lift and carry and just glide. And these are the things that I try to give back to them. It's empowering to know one's body, to be happy, to be free, to smile even. Mm-hmm. Like in all my classes, the first thing I say before we've even started an exercise is, okay, we're going to start this with a smile. Because that's sometimes all you need to do.
Yeah. I smiled at someone walking down the street the other day. I was in a good mood. Walked past them and I just looked at them and smiled, and they looked back at me, and there was this kind of, it took them a while to click what was going on. And then she smiled back like, oh gosh, this should be my response. And it was really nice to see that, because it wasn't a natural thing, and I don't think it is. I think often we don't smile at people enough.
Well, they say that the smile is I mean, it costs you nothing to smile at someone, and it could mean the world of difference to someone who needed it.
You might walk past someone who's having a shit day and give them a smile, and they'll go, oh,
someone cared.
Someone actually cared.
It's an important thing.
Yeah, it is. So you want candy. I want candy. Tell us a little bit and play another song. I'm going to try and play the right one this time. I'm so sorry, Chris.
No, it's fine. Well, can I give you the history behind this one before we play it? So, I won an award for this performance, which the song is a part of. So I did a burlesque tour of Europe last year and managed to make my way to Paris for the first time and was invited to perform at Les Bijoux Françaises, which is the French Kiss Burlesque Festival in Paris, which was, for me, just an incredible opportunity, A, because I'd never been to France, and B, because I'm in France and performing. It's just the best of both worlds.
I bet you were smiling a lot.
I was smiling. I tell you now, my European trip last year was just, I felt like I'd met my spiritual home.
Yeah.
But this performance that I did is called Coco for a Coco, and it's actually derived from a show that I put on for Fringe last year, a full production, where I wanted to play with the ideas of the Tristan intrigues of the Palace of Versailles. So Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI and their possible behind-the-scene going-ons with their mistresses and, you know, flings and so forth and so on. And it was quite a cheeky performance. And a lot of this particular performance, the solo, was brought from Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette with Kirsten Dunst. And just the let them eat cake scenario of that, you know.
Which she never said,
no. But was...
Let them eat bread or something.
Yes, and the cost of bread was too high, let them eat cake, she said.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was really sort of just a play on that whole sort of over-the-top Baroque... high fashion, and I have the frock coats and the undercoats and the frilly shoes and everything to go with it, and it's quite a blinged up performance. And yeah, it starts off with Jean-Baptiste Lully, who is the court composer of Louis XIV, who made many works for Louis XIV, who originated the ballet art form for us. He was the one who solidified and put it into a school form, uh-huh. So that people could learn it. And yeah, I performed this in Paris and won the Grand Prix Award for Best Performance of the Festival. So
that's pretty stunning.
Yeah.
Now, we're only going to play the first part of it because there's another part to this, isn't there? There's a second part, sorry.
So this is the second part. The first part is the music by Jean-Baptiste Lully, the actual Baroque composer. And then the second half is the part where I start to strip off and feed people marshmallows off my bum.
Okay. I'm going to process that while we listen to the song.
Sure.
And we'll come and talk about that when we come back.
Yes, it's true.
It's pretty different to the first one.
Yeah, you know, very much so. That's very, very high energy, high tempo. And like I said, it's in large part derived from the Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette.
So at that pace, how do you feed people marshmallows off your bottom?
Well, there's a section of that giving music where it kind of like crescendos towards the end. And so I do this walkover, land to my side split and pop a marshmallow on my bum and get one of the audience members to come off and bite it off.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
No, it's... We do what we can with the gifts we are given.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I've been blessed
with
a nice wide split.
Okay. Now, I'm going to leave that alone, I think, because there's so many things I could say at that point.
Well, they could always find the pictures of it on my Instagram, so.
So what is your Instagram?
My Instagram? Mm. Oh, goodness me. So my Instagram is @colwage, so C-O-L-W-A-G-E. And I warn you now, it is not for the faint-hearted. If seeing a naked bottom or two is offensive to you, please do not go onto that page.
Well, I imagine that if people are going to go and see the show, they're not going to be easily offended, are they?
Well, unless they've never been before, which occasionally happens.
Do you have people who walk out or who don't know what they're in for?
I have been to many, many shows where we have had people who are completely dumbfounded because they have had no prior knowledge of what burlesque is. And like I said, essentially burlesque is the art of stripping. So sometimes it can just be a glove or entirely everything. Down to a C-cup or a...
Now, I've been thinking about this the whole time I've been talking to you, and I'm going to ask if you saw the documentary. There's a club in France that did burlesque and still does. Mm-hmm. And
there's a few.
Oh, there's a few, but there's a famous one. They did a documentary of it, and it's got an English name.
Crazy Horse?
Crazy Horse.
Yes.
Did you go to Crazy Horse when you
were there? I didn't. They weren't in season when I was there.
In season?
No, they were here in Australia. Australia. They were there in Australia. But yeah.
Here in Australia.
Here, down under.
Because the documentary was amazing. They showed, and some of the dancing there was, you know, they did a whole dance in silhouette. It was just beautiful.
It is beautiful. And I mean, that's a different level of it altogether as well. So Crazy Horses even had the likes of Dita Von Teese headline their shows. I think she did a few months here and a few months there with them. And obviously Dita Von Teese is the first thing that people think when they think of burlesque, but she's only one sort of like facet of it. There is so much more. And yeah, they're incredible. But like I said, that is a very, how do I say this? Systemized form of it. It is a commercialized form of it. Right. Commercialized form of it. That's what I'm looking for.
So it's a tourist attraction.
It is, but there is also a level of art that one can appreciate. It's like a really well-curated gallery. Like, everything in there is made to be seen.
And it's safe.
And it's safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was the thing I learned from that doco. It was a safe place to go.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Paris. I didn't even know it existed when I was in Paris, but I would have gone. But it seemed like a fun place to go. There a lot of clubs like that in Paris?
There are a few. I mean, the Moulin Rouge is still in full swing, even though their show has not much changed since the 60s, including music.
Sounds like a bad Las Vegas gig, really.
Actually, I make it sound bad. It really isn't. Their costuming, their dancers, everything is on point. It is incredible, but it is literally stepping back in time. But it is amazing. It's well worth the see. And there are still places like Siegfried's Folly still does shows as well, and they do some of the original, I'd like to say original kind of burlesque acts. And like some people say the Can-Can was the original burlesque act because of obviously women being empowered by lifting their drawers and showing their panties or no panties as it were sometimes. So like, but yeah, they still hark back to the true form of the art forms and where they derived from. And then there's also the Lido, which does very similar things. And there was even the Manco Cabaret, which is near the Champs-Élysées. And I have a standing invitation to go perform there when I go back, which is exciting.
That's pretty cool. When's your next trip?
This year. Uh-huh. I am hoping. So there is the most prestigious burlesque event that happens in the world, and that is called the Burlesque Hall of Fame, which is held every year in Las Vegas.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. Where else? Glitter, rhinestones, and feathers. Vegas, it must be. And we've only ever had one New Zealander so far who's ever been given the opportunity to compete there. So it is a big competition. It's a worldwide competition, international, and they handpick the participants that they want to bring onto the stage for that, which is why it's so prestigious, because everyone who's anyone anywhere in the world who does burlesque has gone through this or is recognized by the Burlesque Hall of Fame. So I put in my application, so I'm crossing my fingers.
Oh.
So pray for me, team. And we'll find out in March whether I get in or not. But there's a whole glitter tribe of us from New Zealand this year who have applied. So hopefully I might not be the only one. Wow. But where was I going with that?
You're going with Paris performing, invited to perform, open invitation to perform. And I asked if you're going and you said this year.
This year, yes.
That's right.
So the plan is...
Yeah, I'm listening.
You're good. You're so good. You remind me where I was going with that. So the plan is if I get into the Beehive, I'll do Beehive on my trip to Europe again this year. And I'll do a bit of a thing that I did like last year where I went over and just spent 2.5 months touring around Europe performing everywhere, which was incredible.
Sounds amazing.
It was amazing.
You talked about harking back, and I'm going to hark back to something you said earlier.
Yes.
When you talked about Thai Royal.
Oh, yes.
Because I want to talk about Wired.
Wired.
Which was the latest work of Okureka Dance Company, which closed, unfortunately, last night.
Oh, no, I've missed it.
It only had four nights, which is a shame. I was fortunate enough to watch a lot of the process from day one.
That must have been incredible.
It was incredible, and it was. I felt quite humbled by being part of that process. So this isn't really a review as so much as an observation, because it would be unfair for me to review something that I've
been part of the process.
Well, I haven't been part of the process. I've been an observer on the process. And that to understand how you get to a certain point, and contemporary dance, I love contemporary dance. I always thought when I was younger I shouldn't have got involved with theatre, I should have got involved with dance, because it looks like, for men, more work and more longevity. Mm. So, and just... I've seen their work before, and that's one of the reasons I was observing this one. And when it opened on Wednesday night, even though I'd been part of that process, been part of that observing process, I didn't still know what to expect. And once again, they pulled out a work that was, and I would say it was completely different from anything I've ever seen from them before. The sense of movement, the sense of story, was there, even though there was no story. But the beautiful, the story of creation was there, you know, at the beginning of that was there, was very much a part of their work, the, acknowledging Māori kaupapa and tikanga and te ao Māori that existed in the beginning. And these dancers, Claire O'Neill, Aaron Burt, who's actually
he's a
circus performer.
Yeah, he's an acrobat. He's an incredible
Aaron Burt
acrobat.
Is, and he is...
ripped to shreds.
Oh, my God.
I know.
There's not a muscle you can't see on that boy.
Yeah, I know.
And I actually said to him one day, he'd done something, and he walked off, and I go, do you work out? He saw the humour, because of course he does. He was fantastic and strong, you know, and some of the stuff they did relied on his strength.
I saw him a couple of years back when he did the New Zealand Circus Awards down in Wellington, and he had just finished, I think it was a 6-month training in the Bayesian Circus Academy, doing suspended pole. And I think it was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. I was like, holy crap, this man, he can just do things that I like. Olympic gymnast. What is this man made of?
It's a career to watch. So that's Aaron Burr. Keep an eye out for him, because I mean, they were all incredible. I mean, Claire's been around for years as a dancer. I make her sound old, but she's not. But she's older for a dancer. You know, when you think about... Although, I mean, Tai and Tane are older, and they're still dancing, and they're very fit.
But I think contemporary dance has that ability to sort of preserve the body, because it moves in a manner that is kind of... I feel safe and controlled, whereas ballet is quite sort of ballistic and very tough on the bones and joints, whereas
and
contemporary
a lot of injuries,
folds into it a lot more.
Well, they flow.
You listen to your body,
They flow, and what amazed me about watching them develop some of their work is that often they would work out something without music, and it was derived from discussion or making notes or... a concept or a premise, as opposed to a piece of music, which
I love the choreographic process.
And watching them work together. So there's also Rose Philpott, and there's Alali Tapu, Jag Potman, Tanaora Mōtiriti. Excuse me if I said the name incorrectly. And Ceci Torres and Oliver Carruthers. They were all Ollie had just come out of Unitech.
I believe so, yes.
And was doing an internship, and then was bang, he was accepted.
He was in.
and Aowale finished the show with a solo dance at the end, which I think was kind of, it just was so, it was like the full stop. They all did solo pieces, they did duets, trios, dance as a company, moved in sync, moved separately. It was, it's really hard to describe.
You gave me a serious case of the FOMOs now.
Oh, it was just, and it was different from any other work I've seen of theirs before. Nahoe Whā, K Road Strip, Mana Wahine, it had some elements, but this was a new, exciting work as far as I'm concerned.
And
it will come back. It's got to come back. And the only thing is a square. A three-dimensional square made out of truss that they used, and they danced in, so they were quite confined. And when they came out of it, their movements were so much freer than when they were inside, where they seemed to be very cautious. in a very, not in a considered way, but it, you know, it informed the dance, it informed the movement, it informed the interaction. But then they climbed all over it and suspended from it and used it. There was one moment where a couple of them are standing up there and it looks like Les Miserables because they're hanging off the, hey! You know, it was great. And it has to be acknowledged that Sarah Foster Sproul was the guest choreographer, and she did amazing work. With them.
Because hasn't she got her own program?
The Foster Group, I think it's called.
But she's been working on choreography for some time now, hasn't she? Which is soon to debut or has debuted?
I'm not sure. I can't answer that. But she's been around choreographing. It's hard to say that word, isn't it?
Choreographing.
For a long time. John Vitt, who's been around for many years as a designer, the set. And I got the privilege of seeing changes and stuff before it opened, so it was good. I'll tell listeners more about that a bit later. Lighting design, Vanda, Karolzak. I'm terrible with names, I really am. Cross. Sorry, Cross. And Eden Mulholland came in at the last minute and composed the music.
Yes, I love Eden's music.
And he was pretty amazing because he had 2 weeks.
Oh, my God.
2 or 3 weeks. 2 weeks.
But that man's a genius.
He is.
I watched Millia Johnson's pieces, and he choreographed Millia Johnson for, like, WOW as well, I believe. And he's just a magician with music. He just makes such incredible, powerful music that just really takes your heart with it.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And Tanya Carlson did the costumes. And these were, again, these weren't typical Okureka costumes. It was something quite different.
I love it.
And, of course, produced by Rachel Penman, who's been producing for Okureka for quite a while.
Yeah, she's been doing that for quite some time.
Yeah, so it was 55 minutes long. It felt like 10. It was amazing.
I'm sorry that you didn't get to see it.
But
I'm gutted.
It's a really nice piece of work, and I really hope they'll bring it back. But they're actually, I know that Ty is off today to Hawaii because Mana Wahine opens there.
Fantastic.
This week.
Because Mana Wahine is done with
All Women.
All Women.
Yeah.
But what's their group called?
I don't know.
Is it Mana Wahine?
Mana Wahine is that's the dance, that's the work, and Okureka is the company that's produced
it. I'm trying to remember who the dance group was called.
It was, I just wanted to talk about that.
I'm glad you did.
Because you talked about Thai influencing and getting you involved, and they've been hugely influential within the dance world in New Zealand.
Well, they are. They're some of the New Zealand's great contemporary dancers, both him and Hane. Mm. And, yeah, we as contemporary dancers in New Zealand owe them a great debt, and especially me, for having got me to dance full stop.
Yeah. Now I'm going to play a track.
Do it.
So we talked about Mary Jane O'Reilly and...
In flagrante.
El flagrante, which means what?
In flagrante means caught in the act. It comes from the Latin in flagrante delicto.
It's great having an informed person on the show. My wife would have known that. She would have. I think she's told me before, but just in one ear out the other. Language, it's not my thing. But the soundtrack that they used for that show was from Waldeck, who's an Austrian DJ.
Ooh.
And he takes old songs and...
Makes them new.
Ooh. And it was a... this is one of my favourites. So, Why Did You Fire the Gun? And this is the show, remembering that the show was focused on the way men mistreat women. And what women can do about it and empowering them back. It was a nice piece. Why did you fire the gun from Waldeck? We'll be back. We're going to find out where we can see this boy perform his boylesque.
There we go.
Something we did.
really love that track.
It's a great track.
It's good. The whole album, it's Ballroom Stories by Waldeck. One of my favourites. My kids go, oh, you're going to play that again? Because, I mean, both my partner Imogen and I both love it. And it's really nice on a summer's night with a glass of wine. That
like
playing in the background.
Track, yeah.
It's just, you just chill, you know?
It's called a part of their musical education.
Yeah.
It's important.
Well, what's lovely, I do a shout out to my son Josh, who also has got eclectic musical tastes. He's into Grimes and, you know, hardcore American rap and the Beatles.
So he
listened to Nevermind the Bollocks with me the other night. And he also introduced us to a couple of classical pieces which he was listening to.
There you go.
14 years old. Who knows? Who knows what's going on in the brain of a 14-year-old? Anyway, he should be in bed. Now, Mr. Gay World.
Oh,
2014.
13. Yes.
So that's... You just threw that into the conversation during the break there. So, very modest. So you won Mr. Gay World 2013.
I did, yes. That was quite an adventure, that was.
Wow, yeah. And what an accolade, though. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, it means for an entire year, I was a human rights ambassador focusing on rainbow rights.
Fantastic.
And global rainbow rights, yeah.
So that was enjoyable. Did you travel around lots?
I did travel around lots, and it was a thoroughly exhausting tour. So from winning it in 2013 to my first sort of travel abroad in the early 2014, it was just a whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
I lived out of a suitcase for pretty much an entire year and was only home for, I think, less than 5 months of that entire year.
Yeah.
And it was great, though, because I got to speak at a symposium at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow on suicide prevention and youth empowerment, so very much a cause that I'm obviously very tied to. And got to perform my own solo show there as part of the festivities at the Commonwealth Games. And, yeah, attended many, many prides, attended two human rights conferences in the time and spoke to many a crowd and many, many a gathering about many issues that concern us.
Yeah. I bet your parents are very proud of you.
I hope so. I think they are.
Yeah. And you said, you know, in the beginning they thought you might have made the right choice. Wrong choice.
Wrong choice.
What's the relationship around the work that you do now?
So I think they've come to understand that I am a true creative. I would probably shoot myself in the foot if I were to ever do a sit-down desk job, because I can't. It's too many things that go on in my brain, and I would be far too distracted and probably very poor at it. But they support me. They are very much a supportive family. They have helped me through many, many, many hard times. And, yeah, and even to this day, they're my sort of my flag bearers chanting the Go Chris, Go Chris.
Awesome.
Which is great. I mean, that has been a journey in itself. But I feel very close to my parents and closer than I ever did in my life.
And what a journey it's been. I mean, and thank you so much for sharing that, you know, personal journey with us, because it's actually, and I'm just going to mention now that, you know, you mentioned feeling depressed and feelings of suicide and stuff, which is quite a serious issue for people often, and people don't recognize it, or people don't recognize it in others.
Yeah.
But there is help out there. And if you are feeling like you are a bit lost and want to talk to somebody, we've got some numbers here, which we'll also put on our Facebook page when we post this. 24/7, you can call Lifeline, 0800 Lifeline, 0800 543 354. Just knowing that there's actually somebody there just listening, if you want to pick up the phone and talk to somebody, that
it
often helps.
It is so important. Yeah.
And there's a specific suicide crisis helpline, 0508 Tautoko, which is 0508, I should say 0508, 828 865. And these numbers, if you just Google them, they will come up. And if you're, you know, if you're younger and you don't want to talk to adults about it, there's a kids line as well. 0800 543 754. So you're not alone, and don't ever feel you're alone. There might be not someone physically close to you, but there are people who are at the end of a phone. And also, if you're concerned about your own safety, or in fact, if you think somebody else is in danger, then all you need to do is pick up the phone and dial 111. That's really the first thing to do. If you think a friend of yours, a loved one, is in danger, then that's what you can do. And keep an eye on your friends, people.
Yeah.
The year's it's a hard time. And we're coming out of a hard time of year. The Christmas time often isn't the easiest time for a lot of people.
The crazy season, indeed.
Yeah. Now, crazy season.
Mm-hmm.
The crazy pride season.
Oh, my goodness.
Now's your shameless come and see us at the Pride Festival.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And shameless plug time. Shameless plug.
All right. So, shall I just fire away?
Just go for it.
All right, everyone, so get your pens and papers out because this is the information you're going to need if you want to come see me or any of the delightful performers we have. So the Pride show, the Red Room Cabaret Pride season, will be the 9th and 10th of February. Doors open at 6:30. Show starts at 7 p.m. And this will be at the Artworks Theater on Waiheke Island. And the same month of February, we also have a Fringe Red Room Cabaret, which will be on the 24th and 25th of February. So two Red Room Cabarets in one month. Check that out. So if you feel
Where's that second one?
Same place.
Okay. So those of us who aren't on a ferry, we have to get on a ferry to go and see it.
It's a cheap overseas trip. Come on.
Oh, I love it. I'm not complaining. I think any excuse to go to Waiheke Island, believe me.
Yeah. Well, we say make a day of it. Go out, go to some lovely restaurant or beach or even a winery, have a tipple or two, and then come see a show afterwards. It's the best way. And like I said, you can find tickets via eventfinder.co.nz. There are 35 tickets for general admission or 45 if you want a VIP, which will guarantee you a glass of bubbles on arrival and possibly a draw ticket for a fabulous prize sponsored by the restaurants of Waiheke Island. And yeah, we've got some amazing talents as part of the show as well. We've got the comedian James Malcolm. Yes, James Malcolm, who has been twice nominated for the Billy T Awards. So he's a seriously funny guy. Funny guy. We also have the drag performance artiste Constance Mirage, who is formerly of the Disco Bloodbath, an Auckland performance art group.
The Disco Bloodbath.
Bloodbath, yes. Used to do regular performances at the Wine Cellar.
Okay.
We have Amaris Ava, who recently just performed at the Montreal Burlesque Festival in Canada last year. And then myself, King of New Zealand Burlesque 2017, and...
Oh, sorry, another award. Oh, my God. Tell us about that one.
The King of Burlesque? Oh, okay. So New Zealand Burlesque Festival is also... one of the nights they have is the King and Queen of Festival Showcase, where participants are selected from the applications and are asked to perform their best work for the night. And at the end of that... a panel will then discuss and then judge the two winning performances as the King and Queen of New Zealand Burlesque. Uh-huh. And so last year I was awarded the King of Burlesque doing my Coca for a Coca number, which is going to be performed at the Waiheke Island Red Room Cabaret.
An award-winning performance, people.
Yes, a multiple award-winning performance now.
Goodness gracious me.
Yes, I know, right?
I'm in the presence of burlesque royalty.
And I am working for Miss Levito, who is one of the originators of the New Zealand burlesque scene.
Wow.
Like I said, she is the currently the only person who's ever been to BHOF, Burlesque Hall of Fame in Vegas. But she's also a producer of many a sellout show, including Sky City and the Town Hall. And, you know, she's quite well-traveled and very, very international and sparkly herself. So.
Sparkly.
She's so sparkly.
Do you have to be sparkly to be burlesque?
No, you don't have to. It's not a prerequisite, but, I mean, most sparkle-addicted people are. I'm definitely a magpie. Always have been.
Do you find bits of glitter all over your floor at home? Do you have to vacuum often?
Oh, I've got to the point where I just leave it there now. I come to the terms with glitter. The glitter is everywhere.
Do you use environmentally friendly glitter?
Yes, actually, here's another plug. BodyFX NZ, the only stockist of New Zealand's only available bio glitter.
You're kidding me. Biodegradable glitter.
No, I'm a little face for them, so I'm giving them a plug now.
So tell us, because little girls and little boys who like glitter buy glitter, and then it ends up all over the carpet and everything, and then ends up in the waterways and doesn't break down.
And then fishes start eating it.
They die.
Yeah. So it's not that good for you. But bio glitter is amazing because it's actually made from the cellulose in eucalyptus trees. There you go. So
how do you get this stuff?
Well, you can just go to BodyFX online. I think it's BodyFX NZ or NZ BodyFX.
FX.
Like the letter F and the letter X.
Okay.
And they will have supplies there. Bio glitter, I think it's the only glitter that they sell now, to be honest. Or you can go to the shop in Morningside and buy it in person.
Oh, so you can just rock on up and buy it.
You can. And you can buy it by the pound. You can buy it by however much you want.
I'm going to be putting that on our Facebook page tomorrow.
There you
go. I'm looking at it now. Bio glitter.
Mm-hmm.
Bio glitter. It's just, what is it? It's no animal testing.
Mm-hmm.
It's safe for toys, industrial compostable, marine and wastewater biodegradable, renewable and environmentally sourced resources, raw materials. Oh, my God.
I know, right?
And I was being facetious. That's fantastic. You're a shining example to all our youth.
Well, there we go. I was at the World Body Painting Festival last year with Yolanda.
Of course you were.
And Julian. And I ran around in my Pink Panther costume, and because I was in Berlin and I did the Christopher Street Day Parade, I had sweated off all the rhinestones on my the top part of my costume. So they just literally patted on a whole bunch of glitter, and that was me. I was walking around being bio glitter, being like, hey, come look at the store. We have bio glitter.
That is cool. That is really cool.
Thus began the
ripple. Well done, you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I'm trying to be an environmentally friendly person.
It's important, isn't it? Because we've got to leave the planet. I'd like to leave it in a better condition than we inherited it in, because it was pretty shit when I was born, I tell you. You know? People dumped stuff on the side of the road and just left it there. And
This is true. However, I found that New Zealand is one of the cleanest places I've ever been.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to, like, city living in South Africa, you've got a pretty clean country.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Now, this is part of the Pride Festival.
What? This?
Part of the Pride Festival.
The Red Room?
Yep.
Yes, yes, so it certainly is.
2nd and it's to the 18th of February. There's so many events on. You just I'm not even going to begin to even go over.
No,
it.
I think
starts
there's
next week.
Something like 86 events on in total. And Julian Cook, who is the director of Pride, is just an incredible man with an incredible vision, and that poor man is working himself ragged to make sure that this is an incredible experience.
The Pride Festival's, it's a renaissance. It just died, you know.
It did for a while, yes.
Yeah, but it's been brought back, and what an amazing event. A group of events, and for everyone. It's not just a gay festival. It's a festival for everyone. One thing I like, I live in Point Chev, and I love wandering down to
the Big Gay Out.
Oh, my God, it's so much fun. It really is. And fortunately, John Key won't be there this year, so that's...
We'll have Jacinda.
Yeah, because she'll be able to walk.
Oh.
She'll be able to walk.
She should be able to walk.
Because she lives in Point Chev.
There we go.
Yeah.
I love Jacinda. This is going back now. Don't tell anyone how old I am.
Okay.
But when I was in high school here in New Zealand, I was at Birkenhead College, and I was a part of the Birkenhead... I was part of the North Shore City Youth Council, and as part of that, I used to rep for the Northcote Birkenhead Community Board, and that was where Jacinda first started.
God.
So she and I used to sit around the same board table, and I was the youth representative, and she was the council member.
Wow.
So she and I go way back.
She's, pretty incredible.
She's an incredible lady.
Do you know what? When our Prime Minister got pregnant, I smiled all day, because that's a game changer.
This is the New Zealand we want to live in. This really is.
It is. And good luck with your shows.
Thank you so much.
We're going to be running out of time very shortly. And good luck with everything that you're doing. It sounds like you've got a lot on your plate. Dance classes, burlesque classes. If people want to do burlesque classes, where do they go?
Well, they just have to keep an eye out. So I usually advertise via my social media, but also the University of Auckland Recreation Centre. So they have the webpage there, and the classes are all community. So you don't have to be a student or staff member to join in.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
So what advice would you give to somebody like me who wants to do some fitness and burlesque and at my age?
Just get out and do it.
Really?
You have got absolutely nothing to lose and a world to gain.
And what about that kid? What about that kid who was you?
Who was me?
16 years ago.
16 years ago.
And is having a bad time at school, not sure who they are. What advice can you give them, Chris?
Hold on.
Yeah.
You know, things always look so dark at the time, but you've just got to remember that one thing is constant in life, and that is change. And the only thing that makes that happen is time. So you've just got to bite hard, push through, and you will be coming out that other end more empowered than you know right now.
Harden up, buttercup?
I wouldn't say that necessarily, but I'd say you are a buttercup.
Yeah.
And you'll come out hard.
Yeah. The harden up thing I'm not really into.
No.
We want to stop men from having to harden up and actually just get on and soften up a little bit, I think, and just share. So, hey, it's just been amazing having you on the show. Thank you so much. You've been a great guest. And good luck with everything that you're doing, and good luck with overseasing and the competition in Vegas.
Thank you. Well, I hope it all comes through.
If you do, and there's some others from Aotearoa New Zealand who get accepted. Hey, we'd love to have you on the show to come and talk about that.
Definitely.
That'd be a fun night.
That'd be great.
Maybe you could do some burlesque in the studio and we could
live stream it. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Richard, for having me. This has been a delightful interview. Thank you so much.
Now, everyone, we're back again next week. Same time, same place. Hopefully my co-host, George, will be here. I was going to go away for the weekend, but the weekend weather looks like shit, so I think I might stay around Auckland. What's the point in going away camping when it's going to rain? No point at all. Hey, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. If you didn't enjoy the show, tell your enemies. I've been Richard Green. We'll see you next week. Go out there this week and kick some arts. Love it.